So, I have Midwest Environmental and Lindsay Henry and Rick Elgin here to talk about the Ameren site and what they found in their research effort. So, we're doing you two like that. Stand up firm. Let me know.
My name is Lindsay Henry. I'm the president of Midwest Environmental Consultants in Jefferson City. The city hired us to do a review of the Orris Creek property down in Orr and St. James Street. And I'm here to kind of present the findings of what we've got here. The reason that there's a concern at the Orris Creek property is where Columbia Gas Works was sited. It was in operation from 1875 to 1932. There were approximately 40 of these sites in the state. Back in 1994, EPA did a phase one property assessment, did some excavation within Orris Creek and west of Orris Creek. They removed 34,000 tons of contaminated materials and disposed of them. And then in 2013, Ameren came in, did phase two of that project, and this was the property that you guys are interested in. It went through the MDNR voluntary cleanup program, and Ameren got approval through DNR on that property. They removed another 32 tons of material, 32,000 tons of material.
Okay, did you have some?
Is phase one the land that's under the fire?
Yes.
Administration building. Thank you.
And I've got some maps here for you.
Okay.
Okay. The north is up on this map, and then after a while, north will be to the left. So I'll try to point that out. Here you can see, here's the firehouse, and here's the property that you're interested in. Here's Orris Creek. And then again, this is the Orris Creek property over here, and this is where the gas gasification plant was located, and these are the areas that they excavated that 34,000 tons of material. And that was, like I said, back in the 90s under an EPA project. Okay, now we're turning, where north is west, or to the left.
To the left. Got it.
So if you turn this way, that's kind of the way we work.
Got it.
So this is Orris Creek, and that's Park Avenue, and they have these two large gas holders in there. So this is the property that Ameren did their site assessment on. This shows an interesting slide in that the area in the middle that's clear is where they've done excavation, and the areas outside of that just were not remediated as part of the Ameren project. They're still left in place the way they are.
Do you know why that was?
That was based off of the levels of contamination that they found when they did their initial drilling plan.
Okay.
And I'll get to that.
All right. I'll let you keep talking.
Go. Okay. So here's a property again, north is to the left. And as part of this phase one project that EPA did, they put this steel pile wall right along the east side of Orris Creek to keep the contamination from the Orris Creek property from moving into the area that they remediated when they rebuilt Orris Creek and the property where the fire station is.
How deep below grade is that sheet wall?
The sheet wall was, well, it's gone.
Oh, okay, never mind.
So,
okay.
Here are the phases that Ameren did their work in phase one, phase two. Phase three, for some reason, was over here in the northwest corner. Phase four, or there's three, two, three, four, and then five. That's just how they phased their excavation. And part of that had to do with they put up a tent to help contain some of the off gases. As part of that work, they relocated a storm sewer. And, okay, here is an excavation grid. This is the area that was excavated, and every one of those dots is where they took confirmation samples at different elevations, at 0 to 3, 3 to 10, and then 10 to 20 feet deep. And this little weird deal here is where that storm sewer is. That's why it didn't move. Then after they got done excavating, took confirmation samples on the floor of the excavation to prove out that they removed large quantities of the contamination. These are areas that showed at a 0 to 3 foot depth where the certain constituents were above a clean concentration based off of most of this stuff is like diesel fuel range contaminants. This is where from 3 to 10 feet are, where they had 3-4 different areas that were a problem. This is a concern when you're doing waterline work, sewer work, different things like that. This is like worker safety issues. And then here's 10 to 20 feet. There was more, but at the same time, there's not as much of a realm for being exposed to the contamination. Okay, here we are. This is groundwater sampling results. And then here's a Worst Creek property. Going up north. Up north is straight up again. Here's a fire station. And there were four wells. This is what? 8, 4, 6, and 1. And here's two. The wells were scattered out kind of across the city. And these are the sampling results of each one. Up here, you can tell that this darkened phase is where they were above groundwater contamination concern levels. So only one well had elevated levels. It was mostly naphthalene and benzene. And then as they went across, 2005, 2007, 2009, and 2011. By 2011, they were below those action levels. So groundwater was deemed to be clean at that time. At that time, they got a certificate of completion from MDNR through their voluntary cleanup program. The letter stated, this letter is certified that based upon these and other submittals provided, the department has determined that the site is safe for all reasonable anticipated land use. But they also put this activity and use limitation, which limited it to non-residential use. Soil disturbance was only supposed to be done by an approved plan. Had to make sure that construction workers were advised if we got into that 3 to 10 foot range doing water or sewer work. And then you can't drill or put in a groundwater drinking well there, which the city has their own water system. So basically, DNR approved it to be acceptably clean with some limitations. This certificate of completion includes an environmental covenant that is going to be land from now on. That covenant is written to be controlled by Ameren, but it also allows Ameren to sell that process, that property, and move those restrictions onto the buyer of the property, which would be the city.
That it?
That's pretty much it.
Did you find anything that wasn't in the report that they did for DNR?
No. About the only thing that we really saw is the wells.
And they're playing.
Those are still out there and should be abandoned properly in accordance with the well construction laws. And that's about the only thing that we saw that was really hanging out there.
The only two things that I saw here that may be of concern is in the more depth instances, there were more occurrences of something that was potentially hazard. That stuff does not, I take it, migrate. I mean, there were some protections for workers if they had to dig for sewers and so on and so forth, and those precautions were in those limitations. So there was that. There were some kind of hot spots, if you will, on the 20-foot range. When you go that deep, I suspect that being able to cover them mitigates that problem. And then the other question I had was that there were those areas that apparently were not, either were, maybe they were sampled, I take it, but were not covered by the excavation that occurred, the second excavation that still exists. And is there a story on those as well in terms of the numbers? Because we saw the numbers for the excavated part, but not any numbers with respect to those areas in this property that we may be interested in that were not covered by the excavation.
That was based off of their drilling plan. There was another drilling plan that went outside, and those were considered lower levels of contamination that were more like this.
Yeah, those places are cross-hatched there.
Yeah, this area is 0 to 3 feet, so it's superficial. And then the vertical lines were the 10 to 16 foot below grade. Like I said, they submitted this work plan to the DNR, proposed their excavation plan, and that was the approved remedial plan that the voluntary cleanup program allowed Ameren to move forward with.
Apparently what has been put on top of this after they excavated it and they capped it with dirt and whatever fill there was, that mitigates the possibility that those deep-lying potential areas are no longer a problem. Is that safe to say?
The hole was filled with quarry finds, so clean quarry materials, limestone materials, or that material it's a petroleum diesel fuel range contamination, and that does break down over time. And that was a lot of the risk assessment portion is based off of what your contaminant is and what that contaminant will do over time.
Yeah, Pat.
I have a question about, there's this illustration, I think it's on another slide. It looks like there's a storm sewer pipe running across the land. And I wanted to ask John Glasscock a question. It's not there.
Oh.
The other one, it comes from a different direction. It looks like this page.
Oh, that's groundwater.
Well, there's a pipe that Ellen asked about that. So the dotted line, John, that goes across and takes a couple of bends.
Yeah.
Is that a storm sewer or sanitary sewer?
Is that what it is, Aaron? It's storm. It's not
storm.
Sanitary.
Okay.
And that's the same one that I showed you earlier.
They had adjusted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They adjusted.
So when we're talking about the need for capacity in that area, John? Is it part of a plan that you would ever need to go below grade to expand that, or would you use a different approach to adding additional storm sewer capacity in the area should it need it?
I think they rebuilt it, Ms. Fowler, if I can get to this one. Didn't they rebuild that, and that's why it looks crooked, or did they put it in straight?
They put it in crooked.
So this is a brand new here.
Okay.
So I would never anticipate having to go back and do that, because they had to build it to what flow is today.
So for other development in the area, even though that area has been pretty heavily developed now.
Yeah, I think we consider it fully developed.
And so you think there's sufficient capacity, so we're not going to have to, at least through that lot, add additional storm sewer capacity.
Right.
Well, even if you did, my name is Rick Elgin, I'm also with Midwest.
Yes.
If they did have to put in a new sewer line or anything, that's going through the area where it's backfilled with clean material, so there wouldn't be any exposure, you know.
Yeah, it's through that area that's clean. So if you plot that on that right there, it runs from here that way.
Through there.
So it's all clean to fill. So if I have to get in there and dig, we're not touching any of this out here.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping you don't have to get in and dig, because that's one of the restrictions on the...
It's
one of the restrictions on the deed that runs with the land, yes.
But, so, what I'm, we got about 7 minutes, so what we presented, this is all material, or all information that we knew about going in. We had Midwest look at it to make sure we weren't missing anything. I don't believe we're missing anything, and therefore we're ready to purchase because the park sales tax passed. So we want to give you one more opportunity to say, don't do this, otherwise we're moving forward.
Is that your recommendation, that we move forward?
Absolutely. We've been planning on this since Bill Watkins' time, I think.
Have you seen a similar public park opportunity with similar characteristics as what you encountered here?
I'm not thinking, I don't think we need to say whether it's going to be a park or not. We're going to buy it with park sales tax. Because it could be a fire station, it could be other things. Council will have to decide. You will want to have public input down the road. And if it gets to be used for something else, you'd have to reimburse parks their money, because it's not going to be a park. But I don't think we're ready to determine what it's going to be used for. I think that's a community discussion we need to have.
Council?
But your question's really like similar environmental situation. That
Well, that fire station was the same thing.
I was actually asking the consultant, John, if he had seen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I was looking above you.
Sorry. My fault.
So if we ask the consultant, have you seen this same type of land use that we would be able to use for a park?
Well, you can go through a lot of brownfield redevelopment projects that have been turned into golf courses, or other, you know, multi-use areas that are out there. The biggest concern is residential development, where a person would be inside a house for more than 8 hours a day, where they would have a long-term exposure to some of these chemicals of concern.
With the way that it's cleaned up now, would this still be considered a brownfield site? I'm not sure if I'm asking the question correctly, but
I think that because it has gone through the voluntary cleanup program, it has moved past that. Brownfield has some implications on tax or, you know, grant funding and different things. Since this is already cleaned,
is it still a Superfund site?
This area wasn't a Superfund site. The area to the south that EPA did the remedial actions on was considered the Superfund site. And that's why that was done in the 90s, as opposed to, you know, they separated the two projects because they didn't see that this was as big of an issue.
So aside from either one of you, aside from the land use disturbance plan or whatever that MDNR wants, you don't expect any other cleanup or remediation for a non-residential use?
I asked DNR that question and they said no.
Under current laws.
Under current laws. Under current laws. That is correct.
Well, they put it in writing.
They put it in writing under current laws with the plan that they recorded.
And that's the same language they put in to any remedial action that's done.
Ms. Fowler.
I just wanted to say that I was, so the 498-page report was of great interest to me, and I looked at every page. I read the first 30 or 40 or 50 of them. But what I was most impressed with is how many databases track this and how much information there was in the surrounding area of every dry cleaning place and every other fuel oil place and everything else in the area, even as far over as referencing Flat Branch Park, phase one and phase two. So not only from an environmental concern point of view, but from a historic preservation point of view, this document was full of all kinds of helpful information about previous uses in that area surrounding downtown. I've made no secret of the fact that I am excited for us to acquire this. This is in the first ward. This is in my neighborhood. It is surrounded by arts organizations that have worked hard to build a place that is a place for us to go. And quite unexpectedly to me, although if Lisa's here, she knew about it, that there was a grant opportunity, and Veterans United has just awarded the North Village Arts District a significant amount of money for public art, and that just makes all of this even more exciting from a neighborhood point of view to give us both mental and visual rest for all the development that surrounded it. So I enthusiastically support our acquiring this land, and I thank all of you and city staff for your long-standing patience and assistance to the neighborhood every time we came and talked to you.
Okay.
Just one question, and that it piques my curiosity. So that this is all been cleaned up, obviously, and the first phase was all cleaned up too in the 90s, I take it. That 90s site, because it was a Superfund site, was considered a lot more, I had a lot more potential hazard than even this site did. Is that correct? I mean, is my understanding that properly?
That's where the coal gasification process occurred.
Okay.
This is just a storage site.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm otherwise satisfied that this is a reasonable solution.
How big of an issue is Ameren keeping some tail coverage in terms of liability on this?
I can't remember what the contract calls for. But
they say none.
They say none, but I don't know that you're ever able to walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the only caveat I would have that I'm comfortable moving forward.
Yep, me too.
Well, my understanding of a long time ago, I used to work in this field, and I used to do large-scale litigation and environmental contamination. And once you're in the chain of title, you are always in the chain of title. And we are reliant upon federal law that has preempted this area, except for what they've delegated to the Department of Natural Resources, DNR, about when and whether or not there is that continuing liability under RCRA and CERCLA and under Superfund sites. I don't know that anything that Ameren does or even that we do as being in the chain of title as well would change that.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. So the second thing, and I've invited the county commission to come join us tonight to talk about Wayfair or use tax, the state law or the federal law that Linda the state gave us permission to move ahead. And so we need to have a discussion. Do we want to put that on next year? And if we do, what election would we like to do? I like the idea of April, and I know we're going to have at least two open seats. So, you know, that's probably a pretty good time. But I want you all to kind of tell us your all's thoughts and have a discussion with the county commission. So well, I'll throw it open.
First, on behalf of the council, let me acknowledge and welcome Commissioner Janet Thompson and Commissioner Justin Allred for joining us today. We're glad you're here. Thanks for coming to our house, and at your invitation, we'd be happy to join you at the courthouse as well. In fact, I got sued today by slip, trip, and fall at the courthouse, and I enjoyed being able to tell them that actually it's the county commission that does that. So, I think the more we work together, and we were on the same ballot, 2018 mm-hmm. was the last time we tried this. There's now been a Supreme Court decision that makes it easier to do it. The legislature has also given us more favorable ballot language mm-hmm. for this. Have you all had any discussion as to when or if you all with the county may want to attempt this again?
I think it's critical that we go together. And that's been the main topic of discussion, that we join forces and that this time we also move in step with our Chamber of Commerce. Especially the Columbia Chamber of Commerce has, is in favor of moving forward on this particular issue, primarily because as we all know, this is something that affects our brick and mortar. I think of Nikki and all of her colleagues in the district and all of the businesses here in Boone County that are directly affected by our inability to capture this this portion of a tax that's already it's already in place, and we're just letting it evaporate to the atmosphere. So I'm hoping that we can move forward together and combine our considerable power as jurisdictions and also with the chamber's support and assistance. I think that'll be critically important.
Do you know if Ashland, if the other smaller cities are also contemplating doing this?
Some of them are, yeah.
Yep. I know they're interested. I don't know if they've chosen a particular date.
I think it's but again, it's if we, I think if we move together, then we can message it together. We can talk the same, you know, have the same message that we're telling all of our constituents, because all of us are affected by this inability to capture this portion of the tax. That most of these have been voted on by the people. You know, we have Children's Services that was voted on most recent, that and the joint communications OEM taxes that were voted on by the people, approved by the people, and we're not even capturing the entirety of that tax that, you know, most people would probably think would be captured.
Justin, anything you want to add?
No, I just had one question here, and that's how can we as sister government entities work together to best educate the general public on what is an important ballot issue?
You know, and I think I, even when I was running, I wasn't scared to put this on the April ballot. And let me just acknowledge Betsy Peters, who worked on this issue as well. You know, it doesn't, we can't begin collecting the money until January of 2023. Mm-hmm. So I think our window is sometime in 22.
Yes.
I would suggest that we do this in April. It's where we would have the best chance to focus on municipal, local government issues as opposed to an August congressional primary or a November U.S. Senate race that's going to be more nationalized. And Commissioner Thompson, to your point, and I just got up to talk to Matt McCormick at the chamber, we need, you know, our local small businesses have become showrooms for internet sales. Mm-hmm. They come here, they look at something they want, and they go home, research it, order it online, and get shipped to their house. And we're the ones picking up the boxes and taking them to our landfill, and Chief Jones folks are investigating when the boxes get stolen off your front porch, and I just think this really levels the playing field in a meaningful way. And I don't know, Commissioner, if you've had any conversations with Ashland or Hallsville or anybody else as to also going with this to help turn that
the out. Conversations I've had have been if jurisdictions will go, they also want to go together because they see the benefit of our utilizing the same strategy and not just the Columbia Chamber, but the other chambers throughout Boone County doing this, having the same message. Because as you say, Mayor, all of these small businesses are being hurt the same way. And the companies that are delivering these products to Boone County are utilizing our roads, are utilizing our law enforcement agencies, are utilizing our fire. All of those things are direct utilization of services that are paid for by taxes. And therefore, you know, it really is hurting our community and hurting those small business owners. I look at the small businesses and you know, it pains me to see somebody go in and try on a pair of shoes and walk out with their phone in hand, right? And place that order for the same freaking pair of shoes. That hurts.
You know, and the other argument that I used with legislators is that this is also a local tax avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
That this allows us not to raise local sales taxes in the future just to make up for that declining revenue. And, you know, I would encourage anybody who's left behind to think about that when this passes, that this hopefully is a growing source of revenue as more people go on. Look, after the pandemic, most people, their habits are not going to change. They stay home and they move online to have their groceries delivered or goods and services.
It's really a fairness issue.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And it addresses both small businesses and the needs of the community as well.
Well, and even to your point, Mayor, even pre-pandemic, we had already gone to a society in which over 50% of sales were happening online. And that number just increased during the pandemic. So given that, I keep thinking about our Children's Services Fund and what I thought I was voting for. It hurts us in so many different ways. It hurts our community in so many different ways not to direct those funds that we all thought we were voting to go to certain purposes, not even being captured. They're not being captured by anything, anywhere.
Let me ask you this, and this is kind of a question for the commission and my colleagues on council. Have you considered how you might use this additional revenue? It would come into us as general revenue, but do we need to express, like Mike Griggs did a great job of clearly detailing what we would use money for. And I think that's one of the things that we failed to do 4 years ago is clearly articulate, you know, and if it is general revenue goes to streets and public safety, police and fire. And do we need to re-articulate that? Do we need to do something different with that? Has the commission at a county level determined what you would do that, or is that just backfilling lost revenue that you're losing by attrition?
Well,
I would certainly include the county auditor in that conversation as well as their citizen summoning guides.
And in conversations with June Pitchford and, you know, and just general conversations in the commission, we have talked about it. And from my perspective, one of three, right, what is authorized with our current makeup of taxes, there are certain, you know, it seems that the percentages should be allocated in the same way that we thought we were doing when we voted in these taxes. And so I think that's the, you know, that seems to be the most equitable way, and certainly if you look at the pie chart for our use of tax revenue, the vast majority goes to public safety. So go Chief Jones. It's, you know, we have to run a court system. We have to run a prosecutor's office. We have to run a jail. We have to do all of that. We have to run our road system. We have to run all of those services that are integral and constitutional for our entity. So it seems equitable to divide up the money. Should it be received that we divide it up in the way that it's been allocated already.
Yeah.
What's the estimated dollar figure that we've been talking about?
2 to 9 million.
It is a big range. I'm trying to think about messaging and framing it if we're going to say, you know, this impacts public safety and can allow for X, Y, and Z. I think that's important.
This seems to be a logic to what you said, Janet, that, you know, the sales tax has not been collected because people have avoided it. And if it had been collected, it would have been divided up in those same proportions. We have a quarter cent sales tax, park sales tax that just got renewed. We have transportation, we have capital improvements, and we have a general, you know,
the general fund.
Uncommitted expenses that we can use however we want. Mm-hmm. So that would seem to be the logical way to do it. And good messaging as well.
Yeah, I agree on the communication part of it. I mean, I was kind of lukewarm last time we did it because nobody could really explain, like, when it applied and how and who would collect it and all those things. But, you know, with the facts have changed and the world has changed, and it's a lot more clear and it's obvious what the situation is. So I think it's, you know, totally reasonable to go back and ask voters again for their approval on it. And I guess I guess my choice would be April as well. I mean, I guess I could be talked into August, but I wouldn't do November. But April seems the most logical just in terms of all the municipal discussion that would be going on at that time. And I think it'll be incumbent on us, you know, even those of us who aren't on the ballot, you know, to go out and make sure that we're communicating and talking to folks as well, probably more so than we've done on other ballot things.
Honestly, I think you're, to your point, Matt, it can't be just one voice. It has to be everybody on council. It has to be everybody on the commission. It has to be everybody in the chamber. It just, we all need to say it, believe it, and say it. And coming from every perspective, I mean, if it comes from Nikki, it's going to have a different impact to a different group of people. You know, and if it comes from Jeff, it's a different message. So it's however much we can help people to understand how important this it is for our community, for all sectors of our community, the impact it has on small businesses, the impact it has on public safety, the impact it has on our roads. So all of those voices need to be heard.
And from a city perspective, I'm also more comfortable, you know, given the strides, you know, that I feel like we've made in terms of our financial transparency and, you know, sort of getting, you know, the fiscal house in order over the last 4 years, I'm much more comfortable, you know, going out and asking for that tax to be applied evenly across the board.
Mr. Scout, and then Ms. Scout.
I think the culture has even shifted in terms of online purchases because of COVID and so on and so forth. As one of the folks who will wind up on the April ballot, I think it's a plus. I think it's something that we can actually sell in a better way than we sold before. The message was tepid, if you will. There weren't enough folks that stepped up to the plate that maybe should have, and it narrowly lost. But I think it's worthwhile, particularly since the county is willing, and apparently some of the outlying towns and cities are on board with this. The chamber is on board with this. I think the council is on board. I'll let them speak for themselves, but I think it's a good idea as someone who is looking forward to next April.
Well, I think with the 10-way race for mayor, I can see the candidate forums being a real asset, especially if everyone said
that's
yes,
right.
Right. Yeah.
I wanted to ask Matt McCormick, because we keep talking about the chamber, we haven't asked him for any input yet, if that would be okay.
Yeah, let's put Matt on the spot. Are you willing to endorse this proposition last year?
I'm sorry.
Ms. Fowler, would you like to put Matt McCormick on the spot?
So, Matt, as far as timing goes, I've seen you nod your head about you're on board with putting it on the ballot. Yes. As far as timing goes and any obstacles that you see that we should be taking into consideration tonight before we all run excitedly to the April ballot.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for asking.
And I have nodded my head. Yeah, the chamber, this is one of our local priorities. It has become one of our local priorities. It's one of our state priorities the last couple of legislative sessions as well, to give our local community the ability to vote on this. And so what we have discussed is taking a look at how do we start moving this forward. As you've been talking, April sounds, I mean, through the conversation, we have not put out which election would work best, but the one through our government affairs conversations and our executive board is around the April election because of all the reasons that you've heard tonight. It is a local election. This is a local issue. It is one that, as I said, we do support. Now, we actually don't come out for an endorsement of it or such until the ballot language is actually written for it, but it is one of our priorities to make happen for all the reasons that you've heard tonight. We also think it's imperative that, you know, the county and the city and all of us be on the same page as we move forward, because we move forward this as a community as a whole. So I think that's a lot of what we've discussed about this.
So when we looked at the use tax, I remember a gentleman who came forward and said how he was buying construction equipment off the web and he wasn't having to pay taxes, and how this was going to change his business model and negatively impact him. Do you have a sense that there is a segment of our local economy that will be adverse to this, that will push against it? Is there any obstacles that we need to be proactive about in addressing those?
You know, I think you're going to have some of the obstacles going to be the fact that it has the word tax on it, and there's people that are going to automatically vote against it because it has the word tax on it. I think the thing is the education process that we go through, which as the mayor brought up, we didn't do a lot of, wasn't done a lot of, and not everybody was on the same page back 4 years ago or 5 years ago whenever this took place. And so it's going to be that education process of what is a use tax and what does that mean and what does that do for our community. So I think that's going to be our biggest hurdle to make sure that we get over and make sure that we do have the different voices saying this, you know, how this helps our local businesses, how this helps our locally owned businesses. You know, somebody brought up COVID, and one of the things, the habits that it has created is shopping more online, without a doubt. I mean, I know all of us have. The other thing, though, that it has also helped that I've seen, and I don't want to put Nikki on the spot, but I've seen downtown, I've seen all over our community, is also that passion about locally, supporting our locally owned businesses as well through COVID. And so I think that kind of works hand in hand, and why this is a good thing for our local businesses, our locally owned businesses, our locally located businesses, and how this helps those stores fight on the same playing field as everybody else, and then what this does to help our community as a whole, whether it be public safety or whether it be, you know, all just the different parts of what falls under that general revenue tax. And it's making sure people understand what falls under general revenue. If that's where it's going, there, that good understanding of what all this goes to that falls under general revenue. I know sometimes people think, oh, it's just going to general revenue. That's just going into this fund sitting over here for whatever. No, there's specific things that general revenue has to support, and people need to understand and help people understand and educate. It's an education process of what all that supports.
Thank you. Yeah. I yield back my time, Mayor.
I just asked Sheila if...
Can anyone remind me what the deadline is to put something on the April ballot?
We have to have it passed, I believe, by the second meeting in January.
So
that means you'll introduce it the first meeting in January and pass it the second.
How much discussion do you need as a council or as a commission to do that? And is that... you have any qualms about going in April? Is that too soon?
We need to count to two, yes. And April's pretty soon. So,
yeah.
You know.
We have a holiday season.
There you go. We have nothing better to do.
An internal committee that kind of reflects the local tax avoidance, the support of small business, the public safety and roads.
We've just started. We've started discussing that, but a lot of that depending on the timing of which ballot it was going on to.
So we will, the two of us will go back to our house. You all are more than welcome to come to our house anytime, but we'll go back to our house and discuss, and we'll be back in touch on April.
I think that's where where I'm hearing. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know that we have an alternative.
All these houses are in the same neighborhood.
There you go. We are next door neighbors.
It's quite walkable.
It's quite an ordinance the 1st of January to introduce, so.
Not sure we need to wait that long.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Depends on when Nancy drafts it.
Well, I'll make sure.
Language and.
Yeah. I'll make sure we get it passed in time.
Want it to be right. We're already at, might as well do it in December.
Okay. We'll do.
That way you can start the awareness campaign.
January 1.
Yep.
And if you need someone on a committee for this, I'd be happy to do it again.
Great.
Hopefully better than last time.
Thank you both for coming.
Well, and we'll probably have Nancy, we'll have CJ talk to Nancy so that we
integrate. And then would you mind to reach out to Ashland?
We will do, and we will reach out to all of our sister jurisdictions. And
if we can share our model ordinance or anything like that, happy to do that as well.
The more we as CJ always says, if we're singing from the same sheet of music, it makes it a whole lot easier.
You know, Matt and just everybody else, the only confusing thing is when we do go together, people are confused because they see it on the ballot twice.
That they have to check
it
twice.
They have to pass it in the city. They have to pass it in the county and have to pass it in the city. Mm-hmm. Why am I voting on this twice? So, I don't know any other, I don't know any way to avoid that.
Yeah.
It's just.
That's education again.
Yeah.
Well, it's messaging.
How do I fill this out?
And why?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
We appreciate
it.
Thanks.
So our last item is Columbia Community Land Trust. The contract with them, I believe, expires at the end of the year. So I wanted Tim to present to you all. I'm proposing to extend it another year so we can decide on how we're going to move forward with the land trust. So, Tim?
We're going to need a laptop.
There you go.
Yeah.
The clickers here.
It seems like that. It's kind of an awkward thing. We also need the county back into this conversation about community time.
We sure could find that with Jamie.
You can sit wherever you want.
You
have the chair if you want it. Do you like this chair?
We have to partner on pushing together a conversation about bringing the people together sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we got it.
Good.
You got 5 minutes. An extra 5.
Because we got to drive that bus.
Yep.
Okay, I'm on board. Okay, we'll talk about the end of council.
Susan brought me a special cookie. Susan, the neighborhood baker. She used to like come to my house and put stuff in my fridge. She says, I know this is weird, but I do. Well, she's wonderful.
I'm just standing. It's going to be a long night.
Can we keep moving?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Mr. Glasscock. I'm Tim Teddy, Community Development Director, for those of us who are guests at this meeting. And, we do want to talk to Council about the Community Land Trust, specifically what Mr. Glasscock mentioned, and that's this expiring administrative services agreement that was adopted 5 years ago. It expires first week of January. If we don't renew it in some form, it actually automatically renews on a five-year term.
Can I pause you for just a minute? I see Anthony Stanton and Susan Mays. Well, I know Anthony's president of the Land Trust. Susan, you're still on it, right? Do you want to join us at the table? Or up here? Or Anthony?
We're having a
huddle. I didn't want to talk about you when you're right in the room, so. We don't always get the chance to visit with each other, so whether you want to be there or over here, or whatever. So however you want.
Thank you. I want to introduce the council to Gary Anspaugh, Housing Programs Manager. And Gary was working for Randy Cole 5 years ago when we set up the Community Land Trust. I think the institution has been a great success. Councilperson Fowler is also a member of the Land Trust board, as the council plays on. And there have been discussions recently about a transition to the next stage of the Land Trust existence. But kind of the critical path is getting this agreement renewed. And we'd like to, as Mr. Glasscock indicated, extend it for 1 year. So Gary will fill you in on some of the details here and answer your questions. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you, Tim. Good evening. My name is Gary Anspaugh. I'm the Housing Programs Manager in the Housing Programs Division here in the City of Columbia. And Tim mentioned a couple of the things that I was also going to talk about. But really, essentially, what we're doing is I want to give some background on the Columbia Community Land Trust, how it got started, and then where it's at today, some of the things that we're facing as their organization, and then also with the housing program staff. Back in 2015, in December, the city held an affordable housing symposium, and one of the things that came out of that symposium was the desire to create a community land trust. And so the Columbia Community Land Trust was born during 2016. As part of that process, the City of Columbia and the Columbia Community Land Trust formulated an administrative services agreement. And that service agreement would run through January of 2022. So we're fast approaching the expiration of that agreement. And like Tim had mentioned, and Mr. Glasscock had mentioned, we're seeking to extend that agreement for 1 year to allow the Columbia Community Land Trust to explore options to essentially look at potentially becoming an independent organization or to kind of be partnering with any other agency in town that might want to work with them and create a partnership. Currently, the Housing Programs Division staff conducts all the day-to-day operations of the Land Trust. Housing Programs staff includes myself, Darcy Clark, who is a housing specialist, Jacob Amalunke, who is our senior housing specialist, and Nikki Haig, who is our administration tech. The administrative service agreement, again, expires in January of 2022. The reason for that extension is to help create some additional time for the board to have discussions with local agencies that may be interested in partnering or working with them, and in addition, to also allow the board time to work on figuring out if going a more independent route is something that's feasible. Current portfolio of the Land Trust right now, the Land Trust has been very successful since their creation. My predecessor, Randy Cole, was very instrumental in overseeing their success, and projects on Lynn Street and the North 8th Tullamore Cottage development has really boosted the portfolio of the Land Trust to date. Right now, there's 20 homes in their portfolio. You can see the breakdown right now. 15 of those are owner-occupied. Those are brand new homes that have been built since 2016. Lynn Street, North 8th, Rear Coats, Oak, King, all those are new homes that are owner-occupied. Currently, two are under contract, one is listed for sale, two will be under construction in the short term over on North 8th. So those are the 20 homes that the Land Trust currently has under the portfolio. Asset-wise, their main account sits at just over $135,000. They also have an account to collect ground leases. As part of the Land Trust model, each homeowner pays $40 per month in what's called a ground lease. And that $40 goes into an account to help pay for maintenance issues, mowing, snow removal, and other things like that to help foster that sense of community that the Land Trust is seeking to have. A lot of those snow and mowing and things occur over on Lynn Street and will occur on Coleman as well.
Have you had any homes turnover?
Yeah, we have operated what we call resales, so original homeowners who have sold their homes and then sell to another income-qualified buyer. The Land Trust model provides an initial subsidy upon sale at the time the original buyer buys the house. That subsidy then is passed along to the subsequent buyer, so they can afford to buy that house at a subsidized rate than what you might find out on the open market.
And Gary, the seller also makes a little bit of the equity.
Absolutely.
From
the Land
home.
Trust model does provide 25% of all the equity that they've earned through their payments that is theirs to keep as a seller. 25% of the increased value of the home is also theirs to keep. The remaining equity is then passed along as that subsidy to a low income or income qualified buyer. Really, I wanted to point out some of the daily duties that are going on that housing program staff currently is tasked with when it comes to working with the land trust. The housing program staff is tasked, our main role is to administer home and community development block grants, CDBG funds that the city receives through HUD. So those programs, if you're well aware, you see the recommendations come through our Housing and Community Development Commission. Those fundings are the main duties that our staff has. The land trust has added to that, as that organization has grown, increased their development, increased their portfolio of homes, those daily duties have increased. But here you can see just a short list of some of the duties that the housing program staff on a daily basis deal with and work through. Anything from prepping land trust meetings, we'll have one later this week. We're currently working on putting the agenda together, providing minutes and materials and everything else that we would normally do for our housing commission. We do that for the land trust. Sales and resales, Mr. Thomas had mentioned. We also work with any bills and invoices that come through. We work through all financial statements. We have a CCLT audit that's ongoing right now that's been a big time commitment for staff. But I just wanted to highlight some of these items that housing program staff works on for the land trust in addition to the normal CDBG and home duties that we work with. Yes, sir.
Do you track that staffing cost as a liability to the land trust so you know what that takes?
So going right into that, currently staff from the housing programs division is paid through administrative dollars from the CDBG program and home program. Earlier this fall and late summer, we tracked as a staff time that was spent dedicated solely to land trust duties. And so we basically just did a time study, and we found that out of the three staff members at that time in our office, about a quarter FTE equivalent was what was being spent on just land trust duties. For our housing specialist position, this equaled out to around $15,273 in salary, comp, and benefits. That's what the equivalent of a quarter FTE for our housing specialist position comes out. One of the concerns that we have moving forward, and one of the things that we would recommend with the extension of the agreement, is provide an opportunity for the land trust to help pay an admin fee for those costs to help with those daily duties. CDBG and home admin can be used for projects on admin for projects that are directly funded by home and CDBG. However, with the land trust, while we do have home funded projects, houses that are being built over on North 8th and on River Coast are home funded. So the duties that come along with administering those funds for those projects are eligible home projects. Some of the other daily duties start to fall outside of the CDBG and home administrative guidelines that we're able to pay for on an ongoing basis. So the recommendation that we have is to extend that service agreement that the city and the land trust has for 1 year to help facilitate the potential transition that the land trust is seeking, and then also provide an opportunity for an admin charge to reflect the daily duties that the housing program staff is taking on in addition to the regular CDBG and home funding that we're administering daily as well.
Anthony or Susan, anything you all want to add to this?
Well, sounds like a pretty good presentation. It's about where we're at. We're, as you see in our numbers, our success rates. In the future, we definitely want to keep this momentum. Definitely want to increase our man accounts and our ground lease capabilities. We feel like having the opportunity to look out in the community and look for partners that understand what we do and could be a good fit for us is where we want to be. We definitely agree with the staff burden, and we couldn't have done this without the city staff, and the helping pay for that definitely has been on the radar for years. But like Gary said, even helping pay doesn't help with the burden. They still have a lot to do in addition to helping us. So, you know, in the future, you know, we're definitely looking for an executive director and the money. When we were talking about the CARE Act, and we came in front of your your board or yeah,
public
your, your public in the public hearing. I had asked for $500,000, and that was basic for staffing, because money takes care of the bills, but it doesn't take care of the work, the burden of the work that they do for us. So we definitely would like some relief to help with the city staff get some relief staffing wise. They do a great job for us. So that's where we're moving forward. We want to look for partners. We want to be, like I said in the public hearing, we're that 18-year-old that's graduated from high school and is ready to get into the big world and put our big boy pants on and grow. I think the more that we become not solely associated with the city, well, I feel that there's always going to be a relationship because we are and we're a great asset to you. We retain your funds and we keep recycling them. You know, while versus before we existed, you spend some CDBG money, it can be gone in 5 years. You spend it on a house, they resell it, it's gone. While with us, we keep recycling that money over and over and over. So I'm sure we're a good asset to you, so we know that there's going to be a relationship with you guys. We just want to become a little more independent, a little more flexible with what we can do. And I think a lot of donors and a lot of other business entities would feel more comfortable if we weren't so lockstep and at the hip with the city. So that's where our future is. And this year definitely would be great to use as a transition period where we're looking for our next move. And this time gives us, that year gives us a time to really be thorough and find our next partners.
So I am the liaison member, and I zoom into their meetings on a regular basis. I may have missed one or two. But you've been on a pace to build 4 or 5 houses a year.
Yes.
And I and my neighborhood delight in every time we drive by Cullimore Cottages, and that's a process that's still ongoing. But how is it that, what I want to make sure in this year of transition, that we don't cut off the ability for you to continue to move forward in building 4 or 5 houses a year. You also, we have enjoyed a relationship where when the city acquires empty lots, particularly in the first ward, those have become available to the land trust for building. And so where are we with that, and does this administrative year of transition interrupt any of that?
We're still trying to finish out Cullimore Cottages, so that's kind of where we're at. We want to finish what we've got on the books already. Good question, and my answer would be, you know, I kind of use the parent-child relationship. Even though I'm 18 and the city is our mom, you're not just going to just abandon us. You know, our relationship changes. The relationship changes, and that's kind of where we're at. How does the relationship with the city change? And you're right. We still want that same kind of benefit and that relationship of acquiring land. We use it, flip it into affordable housing, and build to our portfolio. We still want that, you know. We still want to be your favorite child when it pertains to affordable housing. I think we're one of the best solutions we got. So, you know, investing from the business perspective, we're a good return on investment, and we keep recycling your money over and over and over again. So, from a business perspective, we're a good bet.
I have another follow-up question, Mayor. And it may be for the city manager. I recall, and I went to look in the various reports, and I couldn't find it yesterday and today, but I recall a conversation where some of the money had been set aside to purchase that additional lot at the top of North. Okay, there's Rear Coats and North A Street, and Cullimore Cottages is in between. And there's a lot at the very top that right now is undeveloped, but certainly would be beneficial to the Cullimore Cottages project. So do we have money set aside for that? And as part of this administrative agreement, can we go forward in acquiring that land and conveying it into the land trust?
There's 100,000 council reserves set aside for that purpose.
have we engaged in a discussion with the owner of the land about whether or not they would sell it to us for that amount?
I have not, not at this time.
So how do I nudge that along so we make sure that we make that happen in this year of transition, hopefully sooner rather than later?
Well, I would need four of you to nudge it along.
Okay, so I'm going to ask if we can also nudge that along since those monies have been set aside. It may not be enough. I don't know that anybody has even hazarded a guess as to what the, I don't even know who the owner is, but I just know that there is an empty lot at the top and we've been talking about it since we acquired the land for Cullimore Cottages.
I'd want to have some more conversation.
I remember looking at that and it was quite overpriced at the time. I don't mind looking at it, but not, you know, maybe it's become more reasonable for the size of the property. But I guess I'd go with the mayor. I'd like more conversation about it, but it's not a bad idea.
Just so you know, that, what was it, 4 years ago, I think? Didn't we pay $75,000 each for the two lots?
Yeah.
There's three lots for Cullimore Cottages, and we've paid $60,000 and $75,000 for those other three.
Make that project contiguous.
Yeah, to make that project contiguous. So
$60,000, $75,000, $75,000?
Yes. $60,000. I believe it was $60,000. I don't know exactly the first one. I think it's the second. The next two were $75,000.
Okay. Might we agree to inquire? As to?
Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily, would not necessarily like to speak to $100,000, but.
At last check, and this has been 2.5 weeks ago, it was listed at $75,000. I don't know if that's still current, and it would require me to check again. That came from a listing online. That was what it was listed at that time. I can't speak to the relative accuracy of that.
I think we'd want to have a conversation about land use.
Yeah.
You know, what are we programming it for? Is it for additional houses? And how many? Because there'll be an additional subsidy that we'll have to plan for.
I'd like to see a map. I don't even know what we're talking about.
Okay.
Can we see a map and move that conversation along, though? At a subsequent meeting, not tonight,
yeah.
A subsequent meeting.
Would anyone like more information on that?
That's reasonable. I think kind of a global look at what's available and where you tend to go. I think
sorry, go ahead, Anthony.
Well, Carl just introduced the idea of other lots that are available. I was focused on the lot on the top there.
That's where I'm going too. I want to think bigger about this. Nancy, do you remember the legal structure of the land trust? Do you recall what it is? Is it a 501c3, a C4, is it a municipal corporation, is it a wholly owned subsidiary of the city?
I believe it is.
It's a
C3.
And the bylaws are that the council appoints their board of directors?
Yes.
There are requirements as to who and where they come from, yes.
Okay.
And thirds.
So, to Anthony's point, you'll never be separate from the city. I would like to figure out a way that we continue to mature the organization. And I think part of it is, extending the lease gives us some time to think about that. I think if the budget allows, having some type of payment for the actual cost of senior staff is an important maturation, but it's also an important accounting mechanism to actually reflect what the not-for-profit is doing and spending and incurring and benefiting from, and that may not be the full 15,000. I don't know, and like you, I don't want to cripple its mission when we have a nexus with CDBG and home funds for purchase and management, things like that. That makes sense, but I also think having some type of contribution for that or pay true market value is a good test for whether they can eventually stand on its own. We have $2 million in American Rescue Plan home funds coming to us set aside for housing-related projects. I would like for council to consider a relationship between the Housing Authority and the Land Trust. Randy Cole staffed this group from its creation. I'd like to see that if they're receptive to it and the land trust is receptive to it, how do we
explore opportunities to, I would like to see at least half of that money, if not a substantial portion of that $2 million, go to the Housing Authority for a project that may include the land trust, and maybe we do much more than just another lot. Maybe they acquire a bigger piece of land that they continue to manage the land. Housing Authority manages another component of it. They still remain autonomous, but we begin to move this administrative agreement over to the Housing Authority portfolio so that it is part of that continuum, that housing continuum, that fit as people come into one, they go into another, they eventually own a home in the land trust, they sell the home from the land trust, and they get a freestanding
continuum.
Home.
Continuum.
Right.
So,
you all thoughts on that?
Randy Cole invited me to a meeting early on. I think it was in July, and I sat with his board, and we talked about the land trust as a concept. And I was concerned after that meeting, and so perhaps they have evolved in their thinking about it. But the impression I got from the conversation we had was that they were not interested in a standalone, like retaining the things that are working right now for the land trust. It has residents on their board. They have autonomy in decision making. They have the ability to, well, they're working on the ability to raise funds in addition to the funding they get from the city. And so I am hopeful we can come to some kind of agreement that that retains all the hard work that the board has done in building that capacity within its members, particularly the ones that are residents within the housing. I grew up in a community, different but the same, and the value of having that kind of day-to-day buy-in and involvement of the people who live there is what made the community of Greenbelt, Maryland worthwhile to live in. So we are a pocket inside of a larger community, but some of those values are still really important. And so I know that there's conversations ongoing, but I think we have to be really cautious about the format and the form take if they moved over.
I had a phone call from the Housing Authority after that meeting, and I think they may have been misinformed or confused, because we had a subsequent meeting with them and the city attorney, that I think their response was, we're not ready to take this over now in December when this administrative agreement ends, but that doesn't mean they're more interested in having a longer conversation.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah. So,
just not to stress this analogy, I like the analogy of the parent and the child. And you know, they do leave home, and they do come back to visit, so there's always this relationship. But this idea, and you've expressed this idea too, that looking forward to this as a placeholder for this year to allow the conversation to develop in terms of whether it's some association with a nonprofit or the Housing Authority or whatever, I think it's an opportunity for that conversation to percolate. This is a good way to bridge that gap to that extent. I think the city will always have some connection and some interest in this, but it would be nice to be able to really see this child leave home, if you will, and develop its own potential and its own personality. And I think these conversations may have a lot to do with helping that happen.
Any other council?
Well, no, I mean, I agree that the year is a good opportunity to explore that. I mean, you know, to your point, I was a little concerned last time we had so much trouble finding the resident to appoint to the board. It took several rounds of advertising. Yeah. So, not disputing your point, I'm just not sure that it's always sustainable that way. So, I mean, I think it needs...
It's a hierarchy of needs thing. You know, when you have a lot of pressures to meet your day-to-day bills, you don't see the path forward of volunteering.
Sure. So what is the best way of supporting this organization? I mean, it may not... I'm not sure that it always will remain part of the city. And you said, I mean, I could see a process where it is not, and where there's part of a larger organization, we're no longer appointing board of directors. It's done in a different fashion. The two other points, or questions maybe, can the land trust only do single family residences, or can do townhomes, condos?
Can do other types.
Right now, they're only done single family homes.
Yeah, I mean, I want, you know, so putting in the, you know, in that continuum or of different types of housing, I mean, there may be opportunities to get, you know, more bang for our buck in terms of the number of housing units by looking at other forms of housing. And then Commissioner Stanton, you brought up a couple times the idea of return on investment. So Gary, I'm wondering if there's a way to measure that, like what, you know, the value, what the city's put in, invested, what that equity is worth now. You know, you've got some resale points. You know, can you track that and monitor it? Just,
yeah, I don't have the numbers right off, but that
right.
is something that we can look into and track.
Yeah.
I'm not
sure. Yeah. Okay, great, thanks.
Susan, I'm sorry. I want to give counsel.
I do just want to.
If I was late. I'm going to throw it to
problem.
You. So I just wanted to say the bylaws are set up so that three board members are community leaders, three are neighbors in the area around, and three are residents. So I think the reason it was hard to find board members from that third category was just because there weren't very many, you know, who were eligible. But that's growing all the time. Have you had a problem in the last year or two filling those three seats? Have they stood empty for a while?
No. Initially, when the land trust was created,
right.
there were no. It was a six-member board until we had enough homes that you could fill those spots to where I'm at.
Yeah.
Nothing, you know, no difficulties that I am aware of in terms of filling those spots.
Okay. And I've sort of been wondering, as this discussion has been going on over, you know, the last 6 or 12 months, what are the, you know, the big picture advantages to the land trust, you know, being separate from the city? And Anthony, I think you made a really good point that I hadn't thought of, that from a fundraising point of view, you could probably be a lot more successful at getting donations if you're seen as an independent entity rather than a part of the city. And that makes a lot of sense. So I'm interested to hear from you two. I'm not sure if we're talking about the same relationship between the Land Trust and the Columbia Housing Authority as we currently have between the Land Trust and the city. But if that is what we're talking about, are there advantages to that? Or would you really prefer to be fully independent?
We're still having those discussions.
Okay.
And I did want to point out that the main account, that $135,000, is almost all private individuals' donations.
Right.
And so when that was without a full-time executive director, it's one of those things that every time I don't want to not be factual, but most times when we say, here's our ribbon cutting, here's Cullimore Cottages, we're selling five houses for people with low to medium income in town, somebody will send us their IRA.
Uh-huh.
And if anyone in the room would like to do that this year, please feel free to contact Gary. but
you just have sort of city staff who are probably don't have as much time to do fundraising, and maybe
they can't do
not
fundraising
really
and they can't
able.
Do press releases.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm only here because I read the staff thing. I mean, they don't have time to communicate with the board the way, because they're overworked with all the CARES Act money. So I mean, this is something that. We need to have someone that pays attention to us.
Yeah, I think it's a really good cause, and something that would garner a lot of donations if you were able to kind of run your own independent fundraising campaigns.
Yeah, I think the Lynn Street cottages, when we they went up for sale, I think they had already appreciated, like it was $140,000 originally from $100,000, so. $30,000 of that went back into the subsidy. So the homeowner got to keep some, but that house will always be affordable, even though housing prices in town have skyrocketed.
So to your question about sustainability, we don't want to have to beg for money. We're in a hot market. We're in one of the hottest topics in the public space.
Mm-hmm.
Affordable housing is getting talked about from the president's seat all the way down to city council. So we're in a hot market. We have a great model. We have a great system. We have a great board. We have great support from the city. We're ready to grow. You know what I mean? And that's just the bottom line. So whatever things we need to do that, like my secretary said, an executive director and administrative staff really would do a lot for us because, yes, a lot of the donations we get, that just happens to this through our example or through Randy's exposure, you know, to us and to other people, and people just have been donating money to us. I can imagine, you know, but a lot of things are you the city? We get stuck with you're part of the city, you know, and we're like, no, we're they're our best friend. You know what I mean? But, so the further when they can see us working independently, people, you know, banks and all that, and we're just talking about funding sources. I'm talking about CRA money. I'm talking about, you know, developers. I'm talking about everybody. You know, I'm talking about a cluster of investment groups that come together that want to see this be successful and use it as a tax write-off. I'm not ashamed of saying this is the value we add to you. You need a tax shelter, you want to do all this. I'm down with all of that. And we provide those services. You know, thanks to Susan, we've got a donation bill of rights, we've got all that kind of that system in place already.
I'm only one vote, but I cannot support spending $500,000 on staff for the COT. I will support a creative project that includes a organization like the Housing Authority, and I would not have said this before Randy was there, with a track record of developing and renovating and maintaining homes.
And just to counter that, Mr. Mayor, this is the thing. It's like the next round of startup for us. If we had that executive director, we would. I'm not going to be too brass, but we wouldn't need you too much. I really think we could really get some money moving if we had somebody really focused on it. This is the second round of startup funding. You gave us the start of the first round when we first started. We had the consultant that got us on track. We're moving. You see our track record. You see our revenues. This would be like the second round of investment money. And that would kickstart us to be more independent and get out of your hair. And now we're coming and we're bringing our parents. We're sending our parents on vacation now instead of coming home. Yeah, come on to Hawaii, parents, and you know, we're taking care of all the expenses. That's the relationship I want.
Well, parents sometimes benefit from the fact that they're related to their kids.
Yeah, and that's what we want. We want you to benefit.
Sometimes the kids spend too much when they come back home. Yeah.
My daughter's makes more than me, yeah. So.
But through this housing model have been around for 30 or 40 years, and I think that they've gone through this transition. So I don't know, Gary or Susan or Anthony, have any of you kind of done research on that process and what are the possible, you know, directions?
Because we belong to the national organization, Grounded Solutions, and being able to go to these conferences, we've built relationships with these people across the country and across the world, because most times they bring them in from around the world. Mm-hmm. So there's certain things that we've recognized that the top tier CLTs have, and we're looking at implementing those same things. So Lawrence is kind of our sister organization, so we track them real close.
Have they gone to a fully independent model where they raise enough money to pay their executive director and to put money into land?
Yes.
Yes.
So that's what I'm saying. I don't want you. We don't want your help for two. We just need that boost over the hill to the next phase of our growth, and the return on investment will even be better than it is right now.
So we're out of time. We're bringing back a year's extension, correct?
That's a good idea.